previously on We Live Here?
I have been turned down numerous times only because I have an eviction on my record. One eviction on my record for an apartment that was not my fault. I had nothing to do with it.
Hey guys, it's me, Camille.
And me, Tim. And we are starting the show today with just a little, like a little teeny tiny, itsy bitsy.
Spider.
Shameless plug.
Of our Twitter page.
Mm-hmm. So, we talk about our Twitter all the time on the show, and our handle is at We Live Here STL. So original.
Very original. Anyway, you guys know this is where you can find us on the internet,
mm-hmm.
where you can ask us questions, leave a story tip, and you know, your complaints.
That never happens. Never happens with our show.
Actually, it happened pretty recently, like just a couple weeks ago.
We got a complaint from someone by the name of Smug Liberal.
Smug Liberal.
We all know Smug Liberal, right?
Yeah. Actually, the Smug Liberal. Smug underscore Liberal.
Yes.
And we don't want you to think we didn't reach out to Smug Liberal, because we did, because we were really intrigued by his or her tweets. I mean, it could be a bot.
It could be a bot.
I don't know.
Anyways, we digress. Let's just read the tweet that came our way. And it came after we made an appearance on a great public radio talk show by the name of 1A. It's from WAMU and NPR. Joshua Johnson's the host, the big national talk show. Anyways, they were in St. Louis, and we were talking about segregation in St. Louis. And Smug Liberal, or I'm sorry, the Smug Liberal tweeted us, quote, "Small quibble with the use of, quote, segregation, as it implies an institutional act to separate people rather than people who decide to live where they want to live for whatever reason, be it class or race, etc." End tweet.
End tweet.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to get in touch with Smug Liberal to talk about his or her or bot's tweet. They never hit us back up.
Nope.
And you may be wondering, like, why are we bringing this up? Because it just so happens that this issue that the Smug Liberal has with the use of the word segregation, it fits right into today's episode.
Yeah, because there is a common myth that segregation just kind of just happened.
That's not true.
The racial segregation that we see everywhere in this country is the product of very explicit design by the federal, state, and local governments intended to segregate the nation by race.
This is Richard Rothstein, and some of you housing geeks out there, you definitely know his name.
Yeah, because he published last year what many believe is the definitive history of America's segregated housing policy. His book is called Color of Law, and yes, we recommend it.
It's been getting lots of great reviews, and it is a really good book. And everyone we talk to, because we're out there doing shows about housing right now, and everyone is like, have you guys talked to Richard Rothstein? Have you read his book?
Yes. And we're like, yes, we have. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the last several months, Rothstein's been trying to break people out of this kind of collective national amnesia about the government's role in segregation.
These were policies that were written. They were out in the open, not hidden in any way, practiced throughout the 20th century. And their effects were so powerful that they determined the racial landscape of today.
Rothstein says St. Louis is like a great example of what segregation policies look like.
Mm-hmm. In fact, suburbs like Ferguson or Jennings or Berkeley wouldn't exist if it weren't for federal policies that mapped out where black people and white people would live in our region.
If we understood this history, we would understand that this government-created, explicitly racial policy that segregated every metropolitan area is unconstitutional. And because it's unconstitutional, we're required to remedy it in the same way that we were required to remedy other forms of government-sponsored segregation, whether in schools or on buses or restaurants or any of the other institutions that were segregated until the mid-20th century. This is the one that we've not dealt with, and we've not dealt with it primarily because we've deluded ourselves into thinking that, unlike the other segregations, this one was created by private practice, not by government policy, and therefore there was no constitutional requirement to undo it.
But before anything gets done about it, people have to know about it.
Housing is the most important determinant of the social problems that we have today.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here, a show for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
Before we get into the meat of this episode, if you will, we should just say again that you should really go out and read Color of Law. It is a great book. And really, I would argue it should be just part of curriculum in this country moving forward in schools across the country. But it's not. So go read it and share it with your friends.
Yeah, we're not just saying this because we're like public radio nerds.
We are. Which we are.
We're excited about interviewing this author. It's a really good read. It's a really important read. And we were really excited when he agreed to give us some solo time. So this episode, though, we should note, is going to sound a bit different because Tim and I are going to pop in and out from time to time. But Rothstein is really going to steal the show. And if you're one of those people who's like, I don't have time to read, I don't have time to buy a book or borrow a book, listen to this episode, and this gives you a pretty good foundation. You can kind of think of it as cliff notes.
It was not unusual for neighborhoods in metropolitan areas to be integrated in the mid-20th century simply because workers had to be able to walk to work, and if there was a downtown area where a lot of factories and other workplaces were located, both African-American and white workers had to live in roughly the same neighborhoods. I'm not saying that every other house was of a different race, but in roughly broadly integrated neighborhoods. The city of St. Louis demolished housing in that neighborhood and built a separate public housing project for white families only. Then it switched it and turned it into a project for black families only and created another white-only project farther south of the downtown area. And then the Federal Housing Administration subsidized the development of suburbs all over the country for white families only. Probably the best known one of these is Levittown, east of New York City, but this was done in hundreds of places, including St. Louis, around the country. The Federal Housing Administration financed these developers to build giant subdivisions, sometimes as many as 17,000 homes, as in the case of Levittown. The condition of financing them, of guaranteeing the bank loans that the builder Levitt used to build that development, was that he sell no homes to African Americans. This was written out in the Federal Housing Administration's underwriting manual, so it was a public document given to real estate appraisers everywhere in the country. It specified that no such development could be approved if it had incompatible racial elements, or if it ran the danger of infiltration by incompatible racial elements because it was too close to an African-American neighborhood. I'm sure your listeners in St. Louis remember or have heard about the Pruitt-Igoe Towers in St. Louis. Of course, when they were built, they weren't the Pruitt-Igoe Towers. They were two separate projects. The Pruitt project was for African-Americans. The white project, Igoe, was for whites only. And these were separately segregated, explicitly segregated projects, nothing hidden about it. Soon after they were built, these projects, a development occurred which was similar to what happened everywhere in the country. And that is, there were large numbers of vacancies in Igoe, the white project, long waiting lists for Pruitt, the black project. After a while, the situation became so untenable that the government had to open up the Igoe project to African Americans. At about the same time, as African Americans filled both the Pruitt and the Igoe projects, industry left the cities. They moved out to suburban areas. They no longer needed to be near railroad terminals or near deep water ports. And so they moved out to rural areas where they could get more space. There were fewer and fewer jobs available for the African Americans who were living in these now all African American projects. And they became poorer and poorer. And for the first time, public housing came to be subsidized. So these were federal policies, very explicit, designed to move whites into suburbs, keep African Americans in central cities. And they created what analysts came to call a federally created white noose around African-American neighborhoods in every metropolitan area of the country.
So I want to ask if what we're talking about, what your book gets at, but maybe doesn't get at explicitly, is this just about, you know, a long time ago, people with power in this country decided that they were not going to, or they did not and would not and still do not value Black people, Black life, Black spaces, and so it flows from it. Everything we're seeing flows from there.
Well, this country has never dealt with the legacies of slavery, much less of Jim Crow. Nothing in the 13th Amendment provides for the transformation of slaves into second-class citizens. Yet, in fact, that's what happened. At the same time that Congress adopted the 13th Amendment and it was ratified by the states, Congress also passed a law implementing the 13th Amendment, and that law prohibited discrimination in housing. The Supreme Court prohibited the government from enforcing that law, and so we established a caste system in this country, a lower caste of African Americans, a upper caste of whites, and the policies that we followed over the next 100 years accepted that caste system and in many ways, as I've described, reinforced it. During the Woodrow Wilson administration and during World War I, administration decided that you could immunize white working class families against becoming communists after the Russian Revolution by making them homeowners, because homeowners couldn't be communists, the reasoning went. The Department of Commerce actually sent community organizers around the country to talk to white groups and tell them that moving to the suburbs into single-family homes was a way to avoid racial strife. That was the term they used. But it wasn't a very effective program because it didn't have any money behind it. Working-class families couldn't afford to move to single-family homes in the suburbs, no matter how much the government tried to propagandize them to do it. But the money came to be behind this program during the New Deal. Once the federal government put money behind it, the program became effective.
When did the collective amnesia begin?
In 1968, Richard Nixon was elected president. His first Secretary of Housing and Urban Development was a fellow named George Romney, the father of the recent presidential candidate, and now a Senate candidate in Utah. George Romney recognized this history. He was not, it was not, as I say, hidden. He announced that the federal government had created a white noose around urban areas, and he proposed a policy called open communities that was designed to desegregate metropolitan areas to assist African Americans in moving into previously exclusive suburbs from which they had not been permitted to move previously. He said he was going to withhold funds from any suburb that refused to desegregate. And he actually did withhold funds from three suburbs, one in the Cleveland area, one was Baltimore County, another was Warren, Michigan. And there was a political backlash. President Nixon reined George Romney in. He canceled the Open Communities program. George Romney was forced out as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development at the end of Nixon's first term. And we've had nothing so explicit since. There were some very powerful Nixon administration officials who were very much in favor of Romney's program. Spiro Agnew, the vice president, for example, was a big supporter of Romney because he had been, before vice president, he had been the county executive of Montgomery County. And he experienced the difficulties that Baltimore City was having because of the concentration of low-income families in that city and the refusal of suburbs to accept their dispersion. And so he supported this integration plan. And as I say, it could have gone the other way, but the more conservative, you might say racist advisors of Nixon won out and the program was canceled. The Supreme Court then began promulgating this notion of de facto segregation. and we've forgotten how it all happened. There's no political support today for desegregation programs.
In the meantime, why not just direct resources to Black people, to Black spaces, maybe that are still going to remain segregated and that certainly are right now, pouring resources in there? Because it strikes me that a big difference with the way that Black people are segregated in this country versus other groups is the lack of resources.
Well, you're right. And what you're describing is a separate but equal policy. We should certainly, just as before 1954, we should have improved the quality of Black schools. But that was not a justification or an alternative. It was not an alternative to avoid desegregating schools. By the same token, of course, we should improve the quality of life in existing segregated neighborhoods. But that's not an alternative to desegregating them, any more than improving schools before 1954 was an alternative to desegregation.
You know, if you're a white family and you're living in, let's just say, one of the West St. Louis County suburbs, you have a relatively new home, you're doing pretty well. If you were to knock on their door and sit at their coffee, you know, sit at their at the table and have a cup of coffee with them, what would you tell them to convince them that perhaps they need to start caring about segregation in this country and remedying racial segregation? What would you tell them?
Well, I would tell them the things that I've described so far. I would tell them that segregation is not only wrong and unconstitutional, and I hope I could talk to them about their pride in being American citizens who believe in a democracy and believe in a constitutional order. I would also try to show them that segregation is not in their interest, because in the long run, it's doing enormous harm to this country. But fundamentally, I would never argue that every social policy that we need to follow should be followed because it improves the self-interest of every person in this country.
Can you just talk about the way in which segregationist ideas and policies continue to mutate and change over time, but essentially have the same negative impacts?
I'd say that you're right. Although I would emphasize that the structures that were created in the mid-20th century were so powerful in creating segregation that they are still the main determinants of segregation today. As you know, during the years leading up to the burst of the housing bubble in 2008, African-American homeowners were discriminatorily targeted for exploitative refinance loans, even when they were qualified for conventional loans. But in many cases, the discrimination doesn't have to be explicit anymore, because the segregation is so built into the structure of cities that even race-neutral policies can maintain segregation. For example, the Section 8 voucher program. It doesn't explicitly say that the design of this program is to ensure that African Americans don't live in white neighborhoods, but landlords are permitted to discriminate against source of income. They don't say they're discriminating because of race. They say they're discriminating because they don't want to accept families with a subsidy of any race. Of course, most of those families with subsidies are low-income minority families. These policies build on a system of segregation that was created with explicit racial motivation, but they no longer need explicit racial motivation to reinforce the segregation that we created.
So if housing segregation didn't happen by accident, then it stands to reason that we're not going to fix it by accident either.
Coming up, Rothstein has some ideas for solutions.
All right, let's get back to Richard Rothstein, the author of Color of Law.
You know, when I read this book, I kept the metaphor running through the back of my mind was that of toxic waste, that there was this poison that was sort of through policies spilled all over this country and segregated people out. So can you tell me a little bit about what you see as being from a policy standpoint, some of the remediation that can happen around segregation in this country.
One thing we can do, and I emphasize this in the book, is we can stop misteaching this history to our children so that they will be in a better position to remedy it than we've been. I examined in the course of doing this research the textbooks that are used in every high school and middle school in this country, and none of them tell the truth about how the government segregated metropolitan areas. They use the term de facto segregation, which is a historical myth, as though it all happened by accident. They brag about the great effect that the Federal Housing Administration had in enabling working-class families to move to single-family homes in the suburbs. And they completely ignore the fact that these policies were only for white families and that African-Americans were explicitly prohibited from participating in it. But after the Ferguson riots, for example, the St. Louis City Council adopted a policy that prohibits landlords in St. Louis from discriminating against people who receive federal subsidies for their rent. That was a very small step forward, but the real problem is not the city of St. Louis, it's the county and the surrounding counties where that kind of discrimination is still permitted. So we could prohibit discrimination against families who have federal subsidies for their rent. It's presently not unlawful to discriminate against them, and that would enable some families, minority families, to move into suburbs that are overwhelmingly white. But it would have limited effect because most suburbs have zoning rules that prohibit the construction of apartments or townhouses or even single-family homes on small lot sizes that could accommodate more minority families. So those zoning rules also need to be modified. We have a federal program, a tax credit program for developers of low-income housing. Like the Section 8 housing voucher program, it reinforces segregation because developers of low-income housing tax credit buildings only put them in segregated neighborhoods. There are very few that are placed in middle-class neighborhoods. And the state of Missouri and other states could adopt rules that require those developments to be placed elsewhere. Placed not in ways that reinforce segregation, but in ways that diminish segregation. In the 20th century, when the federal government created suburbs for white working-class families with single-family homes that were from which African-Americans were excluded, those homes were very inexpensive. They sold for $8,000, $9,000 at the time. In today's money, that's about $100,000. Today, those homes in those working-class suburbs that the Federal Housing Administration created for whites only, those homes sell for, depending on the area of the country, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. The white families who were able to buy those homes, and these were working-class families. My uncle bought one of those homes in Levittown, an FHA. He was a returning war veteran, an FHA home. He stocked the vegetables in the supermarket. These were not middle-class homes. Those homes now sell, as I say, for $500,000 or thereabouts. The white families, working-class families who bought those homes, gained over the next few generations $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 in equity, in wealth from the appreciation and the value of their homes. African-Americans who were prohibited from buying those homes and had to rent apartments either in public housing or in the private market in urban areas gained none of that wealth. The result is that today, nationwide, on average, African-American incomes are about 60% of white incomes. But African-American wealth is about 10% of white wealth. And that enormous disparity is entirely attributable to the unconstitutional federal housing policy that was practiced in the mid-20th century and that we're obligated to remedy. The white families who gained that wealth used it to send their children to college. They used it to weather medical emergencies or bouts of unemployment, and they bequeathed it to their children to buy their own homes. So how do we remedy this? Well, one way we could remedy it is if the federal government, recognizing its constitutional obligation to undo the effect of segregation that it created, if the federal government bought up homes in some of these suburbs, in all of these suburbs, a few homes in all of them, for the current market rate of $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, whatever they're selling for, and sell them to qualified minority buyers for $100,000, the price that they would have paid had they been permitted to do so. And that would enable them to have the equity that comparable white families have in the homes from which blacks were excluded.
But you really don't think that's going to happen?
Well, no, I do think it's going to happen. I just don't think it's going to happen in the short run. I'm hopeful that a new civil rights movement will develop and the country will recognize that we need to address the legacies of slavery and of Jim Crow that I've described, and we will address it.
What makes you think that white people who are in power are going to take this on?
Well, you could have said the same thing about in 1950 about school segregation, or about segregation in employment, or about segregation in restaurants, or in buses, or in interstate transportation, or in any of the other areas that we abolish segregation, where we abolish segregation. You could have made the same argument then. In fact, the power structure of the country then was even more white than it is now. So I don't accept the idea that just because the leaders of this country don't accept this obligation now, that they never will. Integration is an attempt to undo social engineering. It's not an initial social engineering. It's an attempt to undo the social engineering of all the policies that I described, where the segregation of the country was engineered by the federal government in a way that it never otherwise would have developed. So generally, this country is extremely polarized around these issues. We have, on the one hand, the rise of some white supremacist groups and neo-Nazi groups. We have a president of the United States who empowers and blesses those groups. That's frightening. But on the other hand, we also have the beginnings of a new civil rights movement. We have the Black Lives Matter movement. We have, as I say, the movement to address the commemoration of slavery and in statues across the South. So I'm hopeful that this new civil rights movement will prevail over the rise of the white supremacy movement that's being promoted by the president. And we'll see, but I'm hopeful.
When should I put it on my calendar? Like you know, like your lifetime, my lifetime, yeah. My kids' lifetime, if I have kids. Like, it's a joke, but yeah.
Well, that's up to you and your listeners. That's up to you and your listeners as to how aggressively they decide to address this issue. It's up to all of us how soon it can happen.
There's one way in and one way out.
Next time on We Live Here.
You notice none of the sidewalks connect. So not only can you not get out on these pedestrian paths to Del Mar, but you can't even go to that other neighborhood on the other side, which is also middle class and upper middle class. It's also a protected enclave.
We Live Here is produced by me, Camille Stanley.
And me, Tim Lloyd.
Alana Sistrunk is our associate producer.
And Robert Peterson, the program director at St. Louis Public Radio, he's our boss.
And from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.